You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Maggie Dawn, you're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the 3 o'clock hour, and that means it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. This week, we've been talking about global power and the intersection of political power and money and economic policy and tax policy. We've heard how our economic policies over the last 25 years have helped contribute to the rise of an oligarchy, basically, in the United States, but that is also global, with a very few number of people basically controlling all of the wealth on the planet. And we've learned about billionaires using their wealth to control the Supreme Court, and we've heard how geopolitics is also affected by money. Now we're going to talk about how those policies and politics and all of that money-generated power impact our democracy. We're going to talk about a thing called austerity, and I couldn't think of anybody better than Professor Clara Mattai, Professor of Economics and Director of the CHE, which is the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She previously taught at the New School for Social Research and Economics and has been a fellow of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. Again, her research on the history of capitalism and this relationship between policy and economic systems and tax systems is right where we've all been spending our time in these segments, Maggie and the Millionaires. And her book title, her first book, really speaks to exactly this. It's called The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Welcome very, very warmly, Professor Mattai. Clara, it's so nice to have you with us all. Thank you for taking the time. Let's start first. What is austerity? Why is this a thing? This is one of those terms, as an economist myself, I hate it when we use words like this because no one knows what they mean. But there's usually in economics like a common sense ability to understand these words. So let's start with austerity. What is that?
Thanks so much, Maggie, for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure. So yeah, austerity is the typical word that is rarely talked about because it kind of streamlines all the economic policies that don't work for people, but work for the system. So it's really interesting, actually, to point out how when we do talk about austerity, we have the wrong definition in mind, because they tell us that it's all about tax increases and public spending cuts. Now, this definition looks at the whole, the aggregate. So it tells us very little about where the state is actually spending and who the state is actually taxing. So really important here is to consider the class dimension. That is something that economists rarely use to figure out that austerity is A, about these fiscal policies that are, one, about cuts in social expenditures. So we see that we have a structural lack of funding for public hospitals, for public schools, for subsidies. I remind people that after the COVID relief plan for children poverty in 2001 were cut, we have child poverty rates in the United States has peaked to over 13%. So that's way over 1 out of 10 children in the United States in child poverty. So while you cut services for the vulnerable, you are ultimately subsidizing large corporations through incentives, through tax breaks, and of course, free-for-all military-industrial complex that is gaining, of course, for all of the massacres around the world today. Just in August, the American states spent $13.5 billion that is sending to the Israel's army right now. So this is fiscal austerity in the sense of the state spending for the few and transferring money away from the many working class people. This is works also for taxation. So where does the state take money from? And it's not just about increasing taxes. It's about the fact that the regular people pay more taxes than those who make a living off of capital income. And this more than me, the best people to ask are, of course, the patriotic millionaires who have been fighting for an idea that actually the state should use taxation to redistribute resources for the many rather than actually use it as a way to protect capital. So this is fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity never operates alone. It usually goes together with other two elements that are very important for economic policy, which is monetary policy and what I call industrial policy. Monetary policy seems like a big word again, but actually it's very simple. The fact that the Fed has been increasing interest rates for over 2 years, this means once more that who is actually bearing the brunt of the stabilization of the economy is working people who not only have higher bills to pay at the end of the month on their credit cards, have higher mortgages, but also the whole point is that unemployment rates we know are going up, which means that people are actively losing their jobs. In the meantime, of course, capital holders have a blast because they get to make more money out of the money they lend. And finally, industrial austerity. So labor deregulation, meaning making labor more precarious, more flexible, and ultimately privatization, which is a big way of boosting people's market dependence. So this is more or less the definition. I conclude by saying that the whole point here is to understand that this austerity trinity, as I have kind of studied it, is not just the product of neoliberalism and the last 25 years. It actually has a longer history. And it's not just bad policy. This is really kind of, I think, the core message for the audience I have today, for the listeners, is that actually we need to realize that austerity serves a very vital function for the preservation of our economy in the sense that it forces people to sell their capacity to work for a lower wage because there's no other alternative. So if you have to pay for your healthcare bills, if you have to send your child to a better school because the public school system doesn't work, if you have to pay high rent, this means that you are more willing to be disciplined by the labor market and accept lower wages. So this is the core of how economic growth functions under capitalism, is actually the possibility of exploiting workers to a higher degree. And I think if we want to speak about progressive politics, then we need to understand why austerity is so much in the DNA of our economic system and what we can do politically to kind of change the priorities of our economy.
All of this so fascinating, right? Because I have training and consider myself an economist, these things that you just ticked off, these three pillars of austerity economics, are talking points that have bounced around for a very long time within sort of the accepted economic viewpoint of politicians and think tanks within the United States. Frankly, adopted by many, what I'm going to call Democrats or liberal progressives, in a way that does not serve what is a liberal progressive aim, which is an expanding and wealthier middle class, right? That wealth, if we're experiencing economic growth, should primarily reward the middle class that provide the labor and the work that is the engine of the economy. Again, those three pillars: fiscal austerity, which basically includes cuts in everything that the middle class depends on, right? We'll spend less, but we won't spend less in military spending or these other things. We'll spend less in the programs and policies that serve the middle class. Plus, increased taxation, largely a shifting of taxation burden to the middle class, away from corporations and the wealthiest people. Secondly, monetary policy, where the Fed raises interest rates. Again, that cost ends up being borne by the middle class, as those that hold capital and can lend it and therefore benefit from that higher interest rate are made more wealthy. And then finally, industrial policy, which led by conservatives on the Republican Party since the time of Nixon in this country, has effectively deregulated labor markets, has attacked unions and organized labor, the very institutions that help workers bargain for greater benefits, greater job security, and of course, higher wages, all of this combining to a destabilizing effect on capitalism. That's where I want to start. Why, or ask next, why do all of these things add up to effectively favoring fascist adjacent or fascist like governments? Why is this contrary, this conglomeration of factors? Why does that erode democracies?
Thanks. There's so much to say here, and you did a wonderful job at putting everything together. So before answering your question, if I may, I wanted to just specify the fact that when we talk about middle class, it's important because it's what we're really talking about the majority of the time is actually the working class who has gained, you know, some form of economic security, right? In the sense that when we talk about class, it's very important to not just focus on the amount of money we have in our bank account, but that is obviously less and less for the majority of people, but where we stand in terms of how do we make our living? Do we make our living by selling our capacity to work for a wage and kind of in this way don't really have a say too much on like what we do at work and what this work is like being used for? Or do we actually control the means of production? Do we invest capital? Do we make our money out of capital income? And this is very important because we realize that actually the majority of us is working class. And this, even if, you know, we make a good amount of money, the point is that we all are all in the same boat in wanting to safeguard some form of protection against what is a generally a tendency of our capitalist economy that is, again, increased by public policies of increasing our market dependence. And once more, the market dependence is what provides our compulsion to accept our subordinated condition in the labor market. So this is very important, I think, because what we would like is to see a broader middle class, but ultimately middle class does not really fit with the fundamental divide that is the grounding infrastructure of our economy, right? So this is important. Now,
I'm going to hop in here. I just want to reintroduce you. We're talking to Claire Mattei, professor of economics and director of the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa at Oklahoma. We've got about 2 minutes left. I want to get back to this idea, Clara, that, well, gee, if we've created these three pillars of austerity economics that basically makes anybody who goes to work very subordinate. We don't get to choose whether we work or how we work or what our work is used to produce. We are forced into these labor markets in this way with very little say over compensation, benefits, or the how of how we work. What does that mean if it's destabilizing a democracy? What does it mean if we don't have those choices?
Yes.
And yet the oligarchy of the United States and globally still need us to work. We're going to come back with Dr. Mattei after these very brief messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
There's something happening here.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. As it is that we are in the 3 o'clock half hour, it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. Today's special guest is Claire Mattei, professor of economics and director of the Center for Heterodox Economics of the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She wrote a book called The Capital Order, How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Welcome back, Professor Mattei. Thank you again for making time. We've been talking about how this economic policy of austerity that makes it very hard for individual workers, and we're all working class. If you get a paycheck, you're working class. That's what we're talking about. You got to work for a living. Makes it very hard for us in the way that our economy has evolved to have any semblance of true choice, right? in the way that we work, and that this concentration of wealth and political power in the hands of very, very few. And again, the alienation of the worker, for lack of a better term, is destabilizing to capitalism. You had some few thoughts on that because I want to understand more why.
Thanks so much. I think it's really interesting if we adopt, and that's what I've been trying to do in my own work, challenge a little bit the lens that is usually used by, you know, mainstream economics. That is the lens that kind of thinks that economists have kind of an objective, hard truth-like lens through which to look at the world. And this ultimately then flattens out the picture ultimately a understanding of reality that hides what is really happening rather than explain it. And so a lot of the role of actually economics as a science has been to ultimately justify this tendency of concentration of economic and political power in the hands of very few. Now, the question about democracy for this reason is a very tricky one, because we are meant to learn since we're little that our economic system is the one that best fits democracy as a concept. Now, if we try to be a little more critical, we realize that democracy hurts our capitalist economy. And this is something that actually then forces us to realize that forms of authoritarian government are not the problem for our economy, they're a problem for people. And I think this is really where the tension is that ultimately this tendency of our economy to concentrate and centralize through this real competition of capitalists that really try to beat each other in order to survive. And again, there's nothing moral about this. It's not about excessive greed. It's too easy to just say, oh, it's because the capitalists are greedy and it's all their fault. No, it's not about greed. It's the impersonal kind of, it's the impersonal structure that kind of shapes people's behavior. And of course, the structure is made by people. So again, we made this type of economy and that's why we can change it. But it's also true that once we made this economy, we are trapped in it. We're trapped in it as workers, in which in fact we lose our agency and have to kind of subordinate our role to others. But it's also the capitalists that have very little choice but to increase the rate of exploitation if they don't want it to succumb and to basically go out of business. So in this situation, the point is that democracy is not really in the picture. When people do want to oppose austerity policies, and again, we said that austerity is the way in which the state actively protects the market by protecting the capital holders and increasing the market dependence of the majority by taking away resources from working class people, then in this case, we realize that austerity is not very democratic. And when people do want to oppose austerity, which is what I think we should try to do in terms of what we want to see next, we see that the establishment protects itself from this calls for greater economic democracy. How? In various ways. Like there's a way to, you know, to insulate macroeconomic decisions from people. Independent central banks that we take for granted are an institution that has been created purposefully to put monetary stability above all else, including above raising employment, right? So this insulation of economic policies is, I think, profoundly anti-democratic. And it is true that historically, I've studied fascism, so Benito Mussolini, the founding father of fascism, to show that Mussolini was adored by liberals in the 1920s because of his capacity to effectively implement austerity by basically silencing workers directly and through, you know, abolishing unions and abolishing possibilities to strike, but also ultimately how then we see that under Mussolini, the economy was working in the sense that profit rates were going up, international investors were coming in. So I think the problem here is not that the economy doesn't do, it's not that the economy in a way wants democracy, it's that the economy does not really want democracy. And we need to try to find a way to force democracy into our economy.
So what should voters look like when they're assessing candidates in this next election cycle? We talk a lot about tax policy, and frankly, we got to tax the rich and the wealthiest corporations more. Again, it's trying to inhibit some of that exploitation tendency of this economy. What are a couple of specific things that voters should look for? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, really important. I think voters should really assert their economic agency by saying no more of this usual rhetoric that is true both for the Democratic and the Republican Party. Let's try to push our representatives to actually work for people and not for profit. Let's put the logic of need before the logic that is actually the logic of our economy, which is the logic of profit. So this won't happen on its own. The tendency of the system is anti-democratic, and the tendency is to concentrate more and more wealth in the hands of very, very few. But given that 62% of American workers live paycheck to paycheck, we need to say without us as people, the economy does not work. There is no value creation without workers going to work every day. And if this is the case, if we are so central, then we need to push politically. This won't happen on its own. We need to push politically and to hold accountable our representatives to actually speak in our interest, not in the interest of the few who profit from capitalism.
That's Professor Claire Mattei, Professor of Economics and Director of the Center for Heterodox Economics. Her book is The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. Thank you so very much, Professor. This is such an important topic. We could spend hours on this. Folks, I'm Maggie Dawn. This is The Maggie Dawn Show. You're listening to on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. You better stop now. What's that sound?
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
I know.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? I'm Maggie Dawn, host of The Maggie Dawn Show, and I am so privileged and humbled to have Senator Tammy Baldwin joining The Maggie Dawn Show. Yet again, we've had you a couple of times, Senator, and times have changed since the last we spoke, so it's really a privilege to have you back. Thank you for making time, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. I'm going to jump right in here because, boy, a huge vote went down recently on in vitro fertilization and trying to protect access for all families and Wisconsin families to that essential tool for building and growing our families. The vote failed.
Yeah.
This despite promises, empty promises, one might say, from the GOP candidate for president that this is something that should be done. Senator, I wanted to get your reaction to that vote, given your lifelong and certainly as long as I've known you as an elected official dating back to the House days and even local government, you've always been such a staunch supporter of reproductive freedoms. Tell me what that process was like and your reactions to where we stand today.
Yeah, so first of all, we all know someone who has struggled to start or grow their family. And in Wisconsin, over 170,000 women and couples have struggled with the issue of infertility. And, a lot of folks have suggested that people were being alarmist that there would be ever a question about access to in vitro fertilization and other comparable technologies. But frankly, after the Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade, we're not being alarmist, we're being realistic. We see that this, that access to in vitro fertilization is in jeopardy. We saw the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama make a ruling that halted IVF treatments in that state for a considerable period of time. That has been reinstated. But we need to make sure that there is a national right to access infertility treatment of all sorts, including IVF. And it was very disappointing to see, by and large, Senate Republicans, except for two of them, voting against making sure that there is access to infertility treatment across the U.S. Especially disappointing, as you said in your question, because Donald Trump on the debate stage said that he was a leader in fertility, whatever that means. We expected that if that was his position, that he'd be trying to talk to some of these Republicans in the Senate and have them flip their votes.
Yeah, it is beyond an empty promise to hear Donald Trump talk about this. He could have whipped votes just as he killed the border bill.
That's exactly right.
And he elected not to do so. When families in Wisconsin struggle, or American families struggle to access IVF because of these draconian restrictions that you have pointed out in states like Alabama, they have no one to thank but Donald Trump and possibly your opponent in this upcoming Senate election, Senator Baldwin. I shudder at the thought of another Republican taking a seat in the Senate. I think it's critical for Wisconsinites to vote for you and protect your seat in the Senate. If on this issue alone, there are many others, we'll get to a couple of those. But Senator, you recently released a new ad addressing reproductive freedoms. Of course, IVF is part of this broader discussion. Let's take a listen to your new ad, Senator.
I'm Tammy Baldwin. I approve this message.
We found out our baby had severe fetal abnormalities and that my life was at risk. But Wisconsin Republicans' extreme abortion ban forced us to leave the state to get the care that I needed. It was a nightmare. Eric Hovde pushed to end Roe v. Wade. And in the Senate, Hovde would give Mitch McConnell the majority to ban abortion nationwide. No exceptions for rape, incest, or the health of women like me. What is wrong with these guys?
That about says it all. It puts the face of families and women and their partners, right? This is about men too. And if they love and are married to women and are trying to plan families. Senator, what is your message to Wisconsin voters with this clear choice on the ballot here in the state for our senator's seat this November?
Well, the issue is about who decides. And Eric Hovde thinks politicians should decide women's health care. But I say women should decide women's health care. And so I'm leading the fight in the United States Senate to restore Roe by putting it into our national laws. I lead a bill called the Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify Roe and also take the additional and very necessary step of telling states like Wisconsin with its 1849 criminal abortion ban and Texas with its 6 weeks ban and Idaho with its penalties of leaving the state to get health care, that you can't pass all these laws at the state level that interfere with the rights and freedoms that are associated with Roe v. Wade.
It's absolutely essential. And I think, again, pointing out, if you're listening right now and access to IVF is important to you, if you know someone who has struggled with fertility, then I encourage you to read about Eric Hovde's positions on abortion and on IVF, because the choice in this issue could not be more stark. Senator, I also wanted to ask you a bit about your lifelong commitment to a fairer tax system. Every day on my show, I do a segment called Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. And often we have millionaires coming on saying that millionaires and billionaires and our country's most profitable corporations should pay their fair share. And that means paying more. You have been a tireless advocate on this in preparation for our interview today. I literally have a stack of documents of all statements and legislation that you have proposed to make sure our economy works for the middle class. Again, on this issue, when I think of your record and your opponent, a rich out-of-state banker, it conjures up the old Monopoly guy in the top hat, right? It couldn't be more stark. Senator, I wanted to give you the opportunity to speak to our listeners and tell them about the work that you've done to make the tax code work for the middle class.
Yes, so absolutely. And when I think about taxes, I think about helping families who are struggling by lowering their taxes and making the big corporations and the super wealthy pay their fair share. And I've done that. I've voted to increase childcare tax credits, as well as the child tax credit, which is a distinct tax credit, because it's expensive to raise a family, to raise children, and to have extra dollars in your pocket to help pay for the diapers and for the childcare, which is extremely expensive. I have voted for what was the biggest family tax cut in generations during the pandemic, when we increased the child tax credit significantly. But I also voted to put a corporate minimum tax in place so that companies that you read about, like Amazon and Eli Lilly, who were paying zero in federal taxes, now at least have to pay a minimum corporate tax. And meanwhile, my opponent, Eric Hovde, is proposing, if he were elected, a new $4 trillion tax cut that would go to corporations and the wealthy, which is the last thing that Wisconsin or Wisconsinites need right now.
I also, Senator, wanted to give you an opportunity to speak on, there have been proposals for nationwide sales taxes, which we all understand is a regressive tax, which is a fancy word for this, making poor and middle class people pay for the tax breaks that accrue to billionaires, millionaires like your opponent, and tax cuts for corporations. Donald Trump is proposing his own effective sales tax that will again harm middle class families. Your position on these sales taxes, on the Trump tax, has been consistent and unequivocally in the negative. Again, I'd like you to give you the opportunity to draw the distinction between your position and your opponent's.
Yeah, and let's just talk about the regressive nature of the sales tax, because, you know, some people think, oh, it's like a flat tax, everyone pays. But think of, if you're a multimillionaire, the percent of your income that goes to things that are charged with sales tax, like your groceries or, you know, it's a tiny, tiny percent of your overall income. But for a hardworking family, the products that they have to buy, I used groceries, but that was the wrong one to use because a lot of food items are tax-free, sales tax-free. But let's just look at, you know, things like getting new sneakers for the kids as the school year begins, getting school supplies, getting
Those diapers,
right. that you're spending a much bigger percentage of your family's income on these things that are subject to sales tax. So by percent, it's much more of a regressive tax than, you know, the income tax and its progressive rates. Yeah. So we really can't hike up those things that have just a disproportionately negative and harmful impact on working families.
The way I like to say it, Senator, is if you're middle class and you get a paycheck, you're spending the bulk of your paycheck on stuff you need for your family. When you're a rich person, you're probably not even getting a paycheck. The bulk of your money is sitting in investments. You're not consuming a lot of goods. So you're going to pay much less of that sales tax. Sales tax, folks, the Trump tax, that's a tax on middle class families. Last of all, Senator, when we spoke a few months back, Joe Biden, our president, was still top of the ticket. I will always have love and respect for Joe Biden, but I am thrilled to have the opportunity to elect Kamala Harris as the first female president of the United States. I wanted to get your reactions as just as a woman about this great moment, this great opportunity, this joy that we're all feeling in this political season.
Yeah, and as somebody who got to work side by side with Kamala Harris when she was Senator Kamala Harris, I see, I've just seen how incredibly, smart,
yes,
skilled. I saw her when she sat on the Judiciary Committee hold power to account. And with that prosecutorial approach to things. And then, of course, continuing that relationship as she was serving as Vice President of the United States. And, you know, just like I lead the Women's Health Protection Act in the United States Senate, when the Dobbs decision came down, that was her, that was her assignment. She is going to be able to lead us in a way to restore the rights and freedoms that have been stripped away from half of America under Donald Trump's influence. And so I can't say how excited I am to see her at the top of the ticket, to see all the grassroots excitement across the state of Wisconsin. It is amazing.
I loved her on the Judiciary Committee as a lawyer, taking Bill Barr, Brett Kavanaugh, and putting them in knots. Go, Kamala. We will not go back. Thank you so much, Senator Baldwin.
Thank
it
you.
Is always a privilege to talk with you. Good luck this November, and we hope to have you back before then.
All right. Sounds great.
Folks, that was Senator Tammy Baldwin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. We'll be back with more after these messages. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Friday. It is the last segment of the week, and it has been a spectacular show. I'd say a show filled with spectacular women, and we certainly have one final spectacular woman to join us for this final segment of the week. But folks, you're going to want to keep it locked because Dom Salvia is coming up next. With the last chance to win in Civic Media's statewide Go for the Green or Gold Text to Win contest, be sure you've got your phone out with the Civic Media app already downloaded. To get that secret word from Dom in the 4 o'clock hour, you're going to text that word on in using the app. That's going to register you to win either $100, some gold jewelry in that 4 o'clock hour, and you'll be entered to win one grand prize, a pair of indoor club level tickets to see the Green and Gold in Green Bay on Monday, December 23rd against New Orleans. So be ready for Dom at the top of the hour. But last and certainly never least, one of these fabulous women, Terry Barr, Civic Media's very own, joining us for what's good, local, and overlooked this week in the news. Welcome, Terry.
Hey, Maggie, and I'm so glad you mentioned the green and gold. That's where I'm starting.
Wonderful.
We've heard news about fewer pumpkins this year, and it's because of the weather, of course. The weather has been so wacky. If I were a pumpkin, I don't know if I could grow myself. But there are some terrific corn mazes, as usual. They're popping up all over the state, of course. And have you heard about this, though? Four are directly tied to the Green Bay Packers, and they are being turned into corn mazes with some of the coolest NFL Packers, anything you can think of, sort of designs that they say are also some of the toughest corn mazes to get through. One of the largest is in the Bondiwell area at Poppy's Farm. And theirs in particular is all about the NFL draft, if you can see it from on top, of course. But the Packers have been going corn maze to corn maze to help kick off the festival season. And, of course, to remind everybody, the NFL draft is now 6 months away.
Wow. I know Bondiwell. I love a corn maze. I know Bondiwell well. I head up to those parts every summer, hanging out on Shawano Lake. And man, a good corn maze is a lot of fun.
And they say these are hard.
Ooh.
And the one in Bondiwell in particular is so big and so difficult, it could take you the entire day.
What is there, like a safe word, Terry, if you can't find your way out? I mean, listen.
I would hope so.
Is it like an IKEA where no matter how hard you try, you just cannot find the exit? Those places designed to keep you in, much like a corn maze.
There you go. So if you do go, Maggie, I want a full report from that corn maze.
I'll have to leave pebbles or something for me to find my way out.
Yes, a little trail.
Indeed. I am a spatial awareness type, right? So I orient off of visual cues. That's an old sort of hiker trick, and you sort of 360 it and you take down markers. But those corn mazes, it all looks the same. It gets a little, what was that movie, Terry, back in the day? Children of the Corn.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh. It is the Halloween season. Maybe I'll really torture myself. Watch Children of the Corn. What was that main character's name?
I think I tried to forget about it.
It was very biblical. He had a very biblical name. Anyways, maybe I'll watch Children of the Corn and then head up to Bondiwell and see if I can scare the pants off myself.
You are double brave, my lady. Wow.
What else you got for us, Terry?
Okay, well, this is really fun. The Price is Right, very right, in fact, for a Green Bay area man. Okay, so his family gives him tickets to the actual Price is Right, filmed in Hollywood. He goes out and he's thinking, you know what, this is just going to be fun to watch the show happen. Well, get this. Kurt Schwiner ends up being called, come on down. All right. So, you know, you get to the lineup and you have to make a guess.
Yes.
And whoever is the closest then gets to be up on stage. Well, Kurt Schwiner ends up on stage. And then he plays. Remember the high-low game? That was one of my favorites whenever I watched The Price is Right. Pretty simple. Here's a product. Here's a price. Is this higher or lower?
Yes.
He wins. He wins a trip to Antarctica. So congratulations to Kurt Schwiner. I've heard he's very excited.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. I would be ticked off. Like, I live in Wisconsin. I do not need extra winter. Where is my trip to Fiji? Gosh darn it. I don't want to go to Antarctica.
I would go for the beach as well, but I guess he was thrilled. And this is part of their doing different nights. So he even made the prime time. So his show is going to be coming up, but now we know what he did. But yeah, it's
well,
a prime
good
time
for
next
Kurt.
Time show. Yeah, it's the global getaway. Oh. So obviously his global was Antarctica.
Well, he will be able to check a box on a continent that very few people have ever seen, let alone set foot on. So congratulations to Kurt.
Yeah.
Way to do Wisconsin proud. We know how much stuff costs around here, unlike JD Vance and his dozen eggs, but it was actually two dozen and he said it was $4 and it was $3. But good for Kurt. I love it. By the way, that character's name was Malachi. I had to look it up, Terry.
Oh, you looked it up.
I looked it up.
That's right.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Terry, for this week's installment of What is Good and Overlooked. You have a beautiful weekend, my friend.
You too, and all the listeners as well. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, y'all. Thank you, Terry. Listen, that's going to do it for me, folks, on this Friday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. I hope you and yours have a beautiful weekend. Dom Salvia up next with that statewide text to win contest. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together.
Hey, I'ma keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.